Good morning, everybody. How are we all doing?
Fine.
Anybody sneezes, there'll be trouble. Oh.
Cough.
Anybody coughs, there'll be trouble.
Did you see that video and said going around Israel? The woman is standing by a bus stop. She's got some coughing and someone shoots her.
Oh, my God.
Oh, well, we're going to keep it light. I was concerned this morning we'd lose people because of the worry. We've gained some people because of the... YU is... Nobody's in dorm?
They are.
Okay, but nothing's happening. Yes, YU's closed down for online classes. We're transitioning until Pesach to online classes. You have a question, Ellie?
No, I was just moving my hand.
Oh, well, thank you. Feel free to do that on more than one occasion. There are discussions happening everywhere, and in a world of interconnected technology, I'm sure... If not all of you, 90% of you have seen the text from Teaneck that went out last night. How many people know what I'm talking about?
No.
Oh, all right. So I'm not going to panic everybody. But Teaneck made the decision to shut down all the shuls and all the restaurants, not meaning no davening, no nothing, for the next few weeks. But it was, unfortunately, that snippet of information was leaked in raw form last night without any explanation, and... Panic tends to spread, and it was made for a very specific, the decision was made for a very specific reason, to do with hospitals being concerned about overcrowding, generally, not because of virus, not just generally. They said we want to limit the spread of this as much as possible. Having said that, I noticed, just in my own experience, for me, those around me, the more that we are on our phones, the more anxious and panicked and isolated we become, ironically, despite the fact we're in touch with more people, because it has a compounding effect that we feel like, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my, oh, this was, it was, and then it builds. And actually on Shabbos, where nobody had their phone on, we had a couple hours just to breathe, where we weren't being bombarded with worry and panic. So I would advocate, in addition to taking seriously measures of keeping hygiene and washing hands and sneezing into tissues if you have tissues and trying not to do unnecessary contact. Also, not just social distancing, but maybe social media distancing in good measure as well. Otherwise, it can become very stressful psychologically to be in touch with this all the time. There are discussions, we'll give more information about changes to what might be happening in the shul here. Essential services would continue. A rabbi yesterday in one of the WhatsApp groups I'm on injected a little bit of humor. It's saying he was imagining all the shul boards getting together to discuss what the essential services of shuls are and who thought the drasha was essential, who thought the kiddush was essential. My father said his shul in England, the film club would keep going and Shabbos morning would shut down because, you know, that's what people think is essential. So, but we are trying our best to not be inactive or just reactive but proactive to make sure that people not only are safe but also feel safe. And there'll be more about that later today. But in the meantime, there was a discussion about moving this class up to the main sanctuary so everybody could have their own row. but so you should feel free if you would like to spread out to do that, and everyone is instructed not to take it personally. But you should all feel comfortable. In the meantime, as long as we're washing hands and we're not sneezing in each other's mouths, please God, we should all be okay. So let's turn to the parasha. Parashat Ki Tisa, which actually, I guess, helpfully or unhelpfully, in Sheni, has a it's actually in Rishon, has a description saying that there was a kior, a wash basin set up in the Bet Mikdash, and if you didn't wash your hands or feet, you died. So there are people who are sending that verse around this week, that yuchatsu yadeim v'raglechem v'lo yamutu, wash your hands and your feet and you won't die. Again, excessive, also humorous, should be taken with a grain of salt. Either way, this week's parasha puts us squarely in between two sets of two parasha, which essentially describe the same thing. We've got Truma Tetzava, which describes what the building of the Mishkan will look like. Then we have Vayakal Bekudei, which describes what the building of the Mishkan did look like. And now we have this moment of pause, in between where we have one of the most dramatic events, biblically speaking, in human history. We have, in the wake of being on the cusp of redemption, they've been freed as a people. The Jews are no longer slaves, but they're not yet a people. They're a mass of freed slaves, but they're yet to have an identity, a purpose, a mission, a goal, and they're just received the Ten Commandments. And in the wake of that, before it gets concretized with the luchot that are brought down, there is a betrayal. They turn away from God, they build a golden calf, which can be read in all sorts of ways, whether it was pure idolatry, whether it was mere panic, but that is the centerpiece of the parasha. But there are bits before and after that we should talk about, because otherwise we'll get lost and drawn to the panic and drama. And in the spirit of us trying to be measured and having perspective, we should see the whole picture. Look at the parasha. So the parasha... Question? Did I hear a question? Okay. Sorry, I'm hallucinating. Maybe that's one of the symptoms. it's not? Okay, that's a different symptom I should look into. okay, so we begin with the census. Ki tisa means when you... What is tisa? We'll put a particular... I don't know if we'll put a pasuk under pressure. We'll put something under pressure later. What is ki tisa? When you tisa...
Count.
So it's translated often as count. It literally means lift up. And the question does become, why is it ki tisa, not ki timna, ki tifkod? Why is this pasuk when you lift up? And there is a sense here that we begin with a census, literally, but we're not counting people, we count money. Everyone gives a machatzit ha-shekel, which the custom was earlier this week on Purim, people give a machatzit ha-shekel, which is a half coin of whatever the currency is, in order to contribute towards the general funds of the Mishkan, and then after the Mishkan was built, they would give a half shekel every year to contribute to the communal sacrifices. Again, earlier this week, Monday, Tuesday, there was a box out Machasit HaShekel so people could give money to contribute to the general funds in commemoration of that event. And I did point out on Monday that usually shuls have a custom to put out half dollars, three of them in a bundle, because it says to count three times. So we had three half coins, and everybody puts some money in to purchase these coins and then puts them back in to fulfill the spirit of the mitzvah. And this year we were told not to put out the bundle of coins because there's no surer way to have everybody pick it up and put it down, so we just put the money in. And it was observing at the time that this means of commemorating our interconnectedness was left absent, but actually was a mark of how interconnected we actually all are all the time. And that is perhaps one of the most striking things about this, that we take for granted how we all share the same air, how we all share the same space, how flying on a plane can be a problem, how often we shake hands and touch people that we're just unaware of. And actually that absence was a signal and a reminder to us of how interconnected we are, which is commemorated by the Machatzit HaShekel, which took place at the time of the Mishkan. Machatzit HaShekel, of course, bred questions of why it was half a shekel, not a half shekel. Why was it half a shekel? Why did everyone contribute by giving half? So you could be the same by, say, everybody give one. Why half? Oh. Yes, because, well, there are different views. I was going to say yes, whatever you said. So yes, correct. One view would be to show half, number one, we're incomplete. We need each other. Number two, to make sure it's a minimal, minimal contribution so everybody can do it. It should be as inclusive as possible while also inculcating a sense in us that we need each other. We're dependent on each other. I nearly forgot, I want to mention today's shir is sponsored in memory of Shlomo ben Aryeh Lev. His nesham should have an aliyah. So that's how we begin. Then we turn from these contributions, which is called kofer nafsho. There is a sense in which the soul is redeemed by a contribution. Rabbi Sachs writes at length on many occasions about how Jews are never counted by numbers, but by their contribution. And he's got this piece he always draws out that the number of Jews in the world is smaller than the error on the Chinese census. He likes throwing that out. I think Gertrude Himmelfarb was the first to put that quote in writing, that we're such smaller number, and yet the Jewish contribution to civilization, to the world, should not go to our heads as a sense of pride, but it should make us proud of all that we do. and that we should count ourselves not by our numbers but by our contribution, and that should be true in our lives as well, generally. That we shouldn't count just what we contribute monetarily, but we should count by what we contribute to civilization, to our community, to our family, to our peers, to people. We then transition from this census to the kior, the building of the laver in which the hands were washed. In Pekudei and Vayakal, we'll talk more about this lava, which has gone into more detail. In terms, what was the hand basin made out of? Anybody know? It's made out of copper. It's copper, something in particular. Copper, marot, mirrors. It was made out of mirrors in particular. And there's all sorts of discussions. And Vayakal Pekudei, I'm going to need as much material as I can because it's just a repetition, essentially. So I'm going to save it for then. But there is a discussion of why it was made out of mirrors in particular. What mirrors symbolize, what they're used for, what baggage they carry with them, and why that was basically what greeted you as you got to the threshold of the temple, this wash basin made out of mirrors, which is a stunning image to have in mind. We'll talk about that in Pekudei. We then transition from the kior to the sacred oil that was made. And this, I mentioned 2 weeks ago, maybe it was last week, the Givat Shaul. Diane will remember. Anybody remember me mentioning the Givat Shaul? Yep. Rabbi Saul Levi Mortiera, who was the teacher of Baruch Spinoza, and then later part of the panel who excommunicated him for heresy. Now, I mentioned at the time, he made it his business to give a drasha every week, every year, based on one pasuk. He didn't give a thematic general overview. He took one pasuk from the parsha and he made that the centerpiece of his drasha.
Did he call it Parsha Under Pressure?
He should have called it Parsha Under Pressure.
Pasuk Under Pressure.
He should have called it Pasuk Under Pressure, but he was in Amsterdam, so he called it something in Dutch. How do you say Pasuk Under Pressure in Dutch? No, anybody speak Dutch? No, a few people speak double Dutch. Nope. Is that an offensive term?
No.
Good. Woo. In England, it's not. Sometimes you get caught off guard and you say something offensive. I didn't mean that. Okay. So he called it Givat Shaul because his name was Saul and it was a hill. It was a mountain of pure talent that he put this together. And he made the choice, not just to basic on one pasuk a year, but he picked, in his first year on the job, he picked the first pasuk of the parsha, second year of the job, the second pasuk, the third year, he picked the third pasuk. And I pointed out at the time, that works out pretty well when you have a dramatic pasuk that coincides with your year in your career. But there are times when you get stuck with a pasuk that leaves you in trouble. Vayedaber Hashem el Moshe l'amor. I mean, there's only so many times you give a drasha on that. You're going to hit that pasuk every so often. And it turns out the Givat Shaul is just the 50 top drashas, one from each parsha. So out of 26 years, they said, okay, we'll take one and we'll print it. And they're fascinating. The one they chose for our parsha, for Parsha Ki Tisa, was not about the Egel. How far into the parsha does the Egel take place? Roughly. It's about halfway in. I mean, you're talking about decades of his career until he can start talking about the Egel in its drasha. So he stuck talking about other things. And the one that they printed was when he spoke about the oil. I don't have the pasuk in front of me. Maybe I should have. But he reads what they had. Anyone got the... anyone Lane? Okay, I'll just make it up. So it says about the special oil was with kinamon and with kane, and it was b'shemen zayit hin, and it's got all these descriptions of a whole slew of ingredients to build the sacred oil that was not allowed to be made for lay purposes. It was made specifically for the temple. And what are you going to do with that? And he actually traces six excesses in that pasuk and suggests that this anointing oil that was to do with Mosaic leadership, the Mishkan and anointing priests, communicates six lessons of leadership about how one should lead and one assures their leadership, their integrity, and their position and respect in the community. So I'm not going to go into all the details on that because I don't have the pasuk and that's not our pressure, but I'll just note that. We then have the incense that was made. That was very important. That also couldn't be made for lay purposes. But Salal is then appointed, and then we're told, "V'shamru v'nei Yisrael et ha-Shabbat." They made Kiddush, because there's a lot of details. We're told about Shabbos. And this will again come up in Vayakal Pekudei, because we've had all the details of the Mishkan, which is capped off with, "V'shamru v'nei Yisrael Shabbos, you should keep Shabbos." When it gets to Vayakal Pekudei, it says, "Keep Shabbos," and then it gives all the details of the Mishkan. And a number of people, commentators, ask why the order is inverted, why we have the details of the Mishkan, then we're told about Shabbos, and then later in Pekudei we have first Shabbos, and then the details of the Mishkan. Again, I'm going to save that for that time, and that's worth talking about as well. Now, why is Shabbos discussed at all in the context of the Mishkan? because it is the source of what is prohibited on Shabbos. The 39 malachot. How many are listed in the Torah of the 39?
One.
Which one? Fire. One. Lo tevaru esh b'chol mashvatecha b'yom haShabbos. You shall not ignite fire. Again, that's going to come actually later in Vayakel. So we'll save that for Vayakel. I'll just tell you all the things we're not going to talk about today. But yeah, there's only one malacha mentioned, but the comparison between Shabbos and the Mishkan, which is repeated twice, is the source that all the activities that were involved in building the Mishkan are what are prohibited on Shabbos, and they were prohibited on Shabbos. They were not allowed to build the Mishkan when it came to Shabbos, and the question, of course, is why is Shabbos more important than the Mishkan? Why is Shabbos more important than building the Mishkan? You would have thought that making a manifestation of divine presence would overrule Shabbos. Why? There you go. Answer is, because it is. Shabbos we tend to underestimate in importance. It is centrally important to what it means to be a people, more important than the divine presence. Where else in biblical history do we have a case where the divine presence is overruled by moral value? Really early on. In Vayera, when Avraham is sitting in God's presence, Vayera Hashem Elav Belonei Mamre, God appeared to him in the plains of Mamre, and what does God say to him? Nothing. He didn't get a chance to even begin, and Avraham says, I'm off, I've got to go. There are people waiting. And at some point, I guess we can save it for Vayera, but at some point we'll talk about the Jewish value of hospitality and how it overrules the presence of God, in opposition to everything we're brought up with generally. We'll press on, and we'll talk about that. It's fascinating another time. We then have the episode of the Egel, which is to do with what we'll put under pressure, where the Jews build this golden calf, and they say to Aaron, Moshe's late, V'yakel ha'am al Aaron. They gather around Aaron. Now, V'yakel will come up in a different context in Pasha. V'yakel has the sense of assemblage. People gather around. But really, if you look at the pasuk, Moshe is late, V'yakel ha'am al Aaron. You don't get a sense that they come in an orderly fashion and say, oh, Aaron, what would you like us to do? What kind of spirit atmosphere do you imagine?
I shouldn't have said El instead of Al. That's sort of like getting up.
Excellent. So this is V'yakel al Aaron. They gathered on Aaron, which the commentators point out, V'yakel El, that they gather to, would have had that connotation of an assemblage that is in order as a gathering, but actually they were piling on Aaron.
Mob.
They know what to do. There was this festering sense of discomfort, of despair. They didn't know what to do. And what did they say to Aaron? What are the literal words that they said? Make for us Ha Elohim, which translates as
God.
Or or judge. Right, there is an ambiguity in the term Elohim. As you'll notice, I'm saying it, not Elohim. Because Elohim is one name for God, but generally Elohim can mean judges, it can mean leaders. And a number of the commentaries say, of course, this was just the depth of depravity. They built another god. This was idolatry. But a number of defensive commentators, the Sforno, Yosef Bechor Shor, and others, saying, of course they didn't build an idol. They're not stupid. They just had God split an ocean. They're not memory lapsing. They understand that God is God, but they understood they needed a concrete leader. And they turned to Aaron and they said, we need Elohim. What is Moshe called? Ish HaElohim, which doesn't just mean he's a man of God. It also means he was the leader. He was the figure. They needed somebody to band around. Yeah. Fascinating. Fascinating that when it comes to Korach, which we'll get to someday, the same mob mentality. It was not an orderly protest or rally. It was a mob that assembled on Moshe and Aaron. Exactly. Now, so they ask Aaron to make an Elohim, to make them a leader. Imagine you're in Aaron's position. Moshe's late. You know as much as they do. They don't have Twitter updates. They don't have presidential addresses. Moshe couldn't say, I'll be down in a minute, hold your horses. He's late. And in fact, there is a mystical tradition that it's not just that Moshe wasn't there, but there was a projected image of Moshe dead in the sky that the entire people saw. Why does that mystical tradition come from?
That
Say again? Did you say you don't know?
No, I said Batman.
Oh, Batman. There you go. It could be that it came from Batman. Where does that image come from? It comes from the pasuk that says, how does the whole episode begin of the betrayal? It says, V'yiru ha'am kiboshesh Moshe. The people saw that Moshe was caught up or delayed. What do you mean the people saw? It means that they noticed he wasn't there. But the mystical tradition says, V'yiru, they saw something. And that somehow satanic forces projected this image, which again, if one wants to go down the mystical road, one can speak in literal terms about a satanic projection. If one wants to go down the psychoanalytic road, one can talk about the panicked, suppressed sense of despair being projected in their mental worlds. That they just, this is manifesting as not just, oh, I'm a little concerned, but my life is uprooted. I don't know how to cope with this absence. And they turn to Moshe and say, Megen Elohim, you're Aaron. You've been told by the people, we're in a sense of panic. We need you to give us some sense of calm. You need us to assure us. We need a leader. So you're Aaron. Who are you going to appoint? You don't know if Moshe's coming. Maybe he's dead. Maybe he's not. Maybe he'll come. So you have to start weighing out best case, worst case scenario. I need to appoint a leader, but I also need to take into account that maybe Moshe's going to come down in a minute. So who should he appoint?
Himself.
Okay, so if he appoints himself and then Moshe comes down, what's the cost benefit? Right, then he has, well, if you appoint yourself, you have people saying, oh, Aaron, you were waiting the whole time for Moshe to go. You just want to be in charge. Sense of distrust. Okay, Aaron, you can no longer be in my administration. Everyone's going to start second guessing you all the time, think you want it. So he thinks to himself, this is what some of the commentators suggest. Aaron thinks to himself, I can't appoint myself because that looks like a power grab. Even if I think I'm the best fitted person, I'll give consultation on the side, but I can't promote myself. It looks ridiculous. I can't do that. It's similar to Yosef. When Yosef comes to Pharaoh and says, you need a leader. Not saying me. I'm not saying me. Just you need some. So Yosef says, okay, if you ask, I'll do it. So Aaron, if they had said, Aaron, be our leader, maybe he would have embraced it and said, I'm doing it for you. But they said, we appoint someone. Says, oh, you want me to appoint? I'm in charge. So he put that to the side. So who else might he appoint?
Sure.
So maybe he should appoint Yeshua. Maybe he should appoint Kalev. Maybe he should appoint Hur. There are all sorts of people. And the commentators again say, well, if he appointed them, and then Moshe comes down, you're going to have people saying what? Oh, well, I preferred Yeshua. Or actually, I preferred Hur. Or, you know what? Let's, you be your Moshe Ashkenazim. We'll be the Yeshua Sfarzim. Let's split up. We're going to have different customs, different leaders. We'll have different groups. It's great. And you have siphoned off unity and things begin to fracture. So what does Aaron do? He says, I have an idea. I'm going to get a leader that doesn't speak, that can't move, that can't plan, with literally a placeholder. So we'll make this calf. And when Moshe comes down, he's not going to get into a fight with a calf in terms of who's going to take the helm. Of course, this was a terrible error on Aaron's part. Moshe gets a little annoyed about it, but the assumption on the basis of these commentaries is this was not pure idolatry, that they just went from Egypt where they had been oppressed and tormented to walking through parted waters, spoken to by God and said, oh, well, right, let's go to a golden calf and worship it. But they were in need of a physical incarnation as a leader. Aaron said, let's do this, thinking it would be the least damaging option. And he learned the lesson that actually it wasn't. And in fact, I'll talk more on Shabbos morning about why Moshe broke the Luchot, but I won't mention this option, which is an option suggested by the Meshech Chochma, that he broke the Luchot because he saw that they were venerating material objects. And he said, "It can't. If we get rid of the calf and I give them the Luchot, what's going to happen? They'll worship the Luchot. I need to get rid of these. They obviously can't cope with physical incarnation. And I need to throw it away." In fact, anyone heard of Aviva Zornberg?
Yeah.
She's great. That's my endorsement. People are in the spirit of endorsements the last few weeks. So Aviva Zornberg has written a number of books on Chumash. She, for the context of those who don't know her, she grew up in Scotland, which we won't hold against her. She then went to Cambridge, did a PhD. She spent a lot of time in Gateshead, so she's kind of straddled different sides of the Jewish cultural community. And she now lives in Yerushalayim, where she teaches in seminaries and private classes. And she's written a book on Bereshit called The Beginning of Desire, one on Shmot called The Particulars of Rapture. She skipped Vayikra, astonishingly enough. She wrote one on Bamidbar called Bewilderment, because it's about the wilderness. And she wrote one called The Murmuring Deep, which is a cross-section of different books in Tanakh, some from Yonah, some from Esther, some from Ruth. And the title, I should just plug, The Murmuring Deep, was taken from a paper that my uncle wrote. He's a psychoanalyst in London. He doesn't have patients in clinical. He teaches psychosocial studies at the University of London. And he wrote about The Murmuring Deep from the beginning of time, the Tahom, which he thought was a helpful title. So she used that. And then she also wrote a book more recently called Moses, A Human Life. There is a Jewish book series that I'm blanking on the series. I think it's Jewish Lives, that's what it's called. And they do a number of biographies of different figures. They've from Marx to people in the Jewish film industry, whose name I'm blanking on. They have Sigmund Freud and Rabbi Wolpe from L.A. Anyone know Rabbi David Wolpe?
Yes.
He's in charge, I think, the largest reform synagogue in the country, conservative in the country. So he wrote one on King David. And they asked Avivi Zornberg to write one on Moses. And it's called Moses, A Human Life. And she goes through Midrashic and Hasidic texts to kind of unpack psychoanalytically who Moses was. And that's her style. She uses Hasidic readings to unpack psychoanalytic issues through the prism of the biblical text. And she has this view of what Moshe is doing here, that he saw that they couldn't cope with the material gaze, G-A-Z-E or Z-E. They were looking at physical items as gods. And he comes down with this set of luchot, and he can't help thinking, when I think about the luchot, anyone here see the history, Mel Brooks' history of, what's it called? History of civil, history of the world. Have we all seen that? History of the World, part one.
Good to be king.
It's good to be the king in France. Yeah, that's part two. I think so. Part one, he has Moses come down the mountain dressed like Charlton Heston, holding three luchot. He says, here I come with 15. Oh! And he drops one and says, 10! 10 commandments! It's very fun. I can't help thinking about that when I speak about the luchot. Either way, oh, I forgot the mental breadcrumbs. Why are we talking? Viva Zornberg. Thank you. When too many things flying around. It's another symptom. When Moshe comes down with all the luchot, he says to he sees these people can't cope with physical objects. They can't cope with incarnation, which of course begs the question about what comes in the wake of the Egel. What does God tell the people to do? To build a Mishkan, to build Kruvim, golden, molten angels in the Holy of Holies. It's an astonishing shift from people who can't cope with material things that Moshe breaks the luchot, which actually God then tells him to get another set and to build a Mishkan. Seems to be diagnosing the misdiagnosis of Moses, saying, no, it's not they can't cope with physical things, it's that it needs to be channeled, it needs to be structured, it needs to be regulated, and it needs to be designed to cater to their needs. You don't just throw up things in the air. And Moshe made that diagnostic choice initially. Either way, that's Moshe breaking the idols. He then has, we have the most potent exposure of Moshe's deepest desire in the wake of that healing, when the people who were involved with the Egel are die in a plague, other people survive, they come together, there's a new covenant made, and Moshe has one question for God. What does he say?
Show me your face.
Yeah, I want to see what on earth is going on. I think I deserve to know what is happening. And what does God say? No one shall see my face and live, but I'll show you my back. I could do with a scratch. Right? It says, have a look at my back, which Chazal, the sages, read as HaKadosh Baruch Hu showing Moshe his tefillin, the knot of his tefillin on the back. And the Gemara in Brachot, for those who are doing Daf Yomi a while back now, because they're already past Brachot, it has a description of what's written on the tefillin of Hashem, meaning Hashem wears tefillin, of course. We wear tefillin that says that God chose us as a nation, our responsibilities. What are the ones that God wears? Mikamcha Yisrael Goyachad Ba'aretz, which we say Shabbos Mincha every week, is one of the psukim that the Gemara says was written on the tefillin of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which again gets into an intriguing realm of anthropomorphism, where God is being suggested to wear tefillin. And what do we do with that? And when it says that you will see my back, we assume that to be a metaphor But Chazal try to read it in more concrete ways for all sorts of reasons. Either way, we actually sing this in Anim Zemiros every week. Again, I don't know how conscious we are of it. Keshe Tfilin Heral Lefanav. What did I say? La'anav, oh right. I haven't done it since I was 12. Anim Zemiros. Actually, I did it a few weeks ago in the shul. Does it start Keshe Tfilin? What's the whole verse? Thank you. The knot of his tefillin was shown to his eyes, tmunat, the image of God before his eyes. So we sing every week that the knot of tefillin was shown to Moses. And it's based on this moment where he says, you can see my back. Which again, in metaphysical terms, is complicated. So what was revealed to Moshe? Was it just a sense of closeness to God? Was it some theological information that was handed on? But again, we'll talk about that another time. The parsha ends with the second set of tablets. And Moshe coming down from the mountain, having not eaten or drunk for 40 days and 40 nights, having inscribed himself the words on the tablets, and he comes down, and now his face is shining. Again, this is the Karine Or, where the misapprehension of Jews having horns came from. Anyone ever had interaction with people who are not Jewish about Jews having horns?
Yeah. Yep.
All right, there you go, interesting. My father said to me when he was a young kid, which would not be recommended today, but they went on road trips across Europe for their vacations. They were not a wealthy family, but they could get in a car, and you could get on a ferry and go to France and drive. And you just pay to stay in a campsite somewhere. So they drive to Italy, drive all over the place, and that was their summer vacation. And they went to Rome at one point, and my father said he was standing in Rome, and he said some people came up to him and started just feeling his head. He read into that they were looking for Jewish horns. Maybe they're just feeling his head. I don't know. It's an odd thing to do, but I guess something must have tipped him to think that that's why they were feeling his head, that I've heard that Jews have horns. And of course, technology is different today. People know what Jews look like. It's rare to have someone today who actually thinks that, but maybe I'm naive and I'm cuddled in a... Ah, there you go. So there are rumors that men wear skull caps to cover horns. It really is just to cover baldness. But, yeah, I can now make that joke. Yeah.
In the early 70s, it was down south, a training conference, and I had a roommate from the Midwest. And I was the first Jew that he had ever met, and he admitted to me a number of days later that he actually was starting to look for the horns.
So interesting. And it is amazing. And I am naive, I guess. It's, of course there are people in the world who have never met Jews. How many Jews are there in the world? 18 million? I don't know how many. How many people are there? 7 billion. It's, you know, of course there are people in the world who have never met Jews. And people believe all sorts of things that they don't know about. So, yeah, and this misapprehension doesn't begin with Michelangelo, but was compounded by Michelangelo, whose sculpture of Moses that is now housed in the Vatican has Moses sitting with two little horns, which, again, if you're looking for drama and you want Moshe to come down to the mountain in a dramatic sense, having two little horns, that's not really that. People would say, is he okay? You know, this guy needs some help. If he comes down with beams of light, that's far more dramatic. And in response to those beams of light, he does wear a veil. We're told that he wore a veil to contain the light, apart from when he was speaking to the people. And Moshe was unaware of this light, we're told at the end of the parasha. Where does the light come from? Why is it there? Again, a hotbed of exegetical activity around this, where this, where the light came from. There are some views that there was ink left over from writing the Torah, and that ink he smeared on his face, and that's what shined. Why was that ink left over? This was magical ink that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave him. Why did he give him excess?
It wasn't ink.
So he chiseled the luchot. Right, so there are some holes in all of this, including holes in the luchot. But, yeah, there are some ideas that he was writing ink on parchment at the same time. He scripted at least the part of the Torah up to where they were up to, historically. Meaning he wrote up to Parshas Ki Tisa. There were views about whether he wrote the whole thing and then revealed it bit by bit, whether he wrote it bit by bit from that moment on, but he wrote the stories of Avram. They were dictated and he wrote it down. Another symptom. And there was leftover ink. And the question the commentator asked, what ink was left over? And the answer will show you how far they think he got up to in the Torah. One of the answers is there is a yud missing in one word in the Torah. Anyone know which word is missing a yud that should have a yud? V'ha'ish Moshe Anav Ma'od. And Moshe was exceptionally humble. The word Anav should be Ayin Nun Yud Vav, and it doesn't have a yud. And the assumption of the commentator is Moshe is doing his best to kind of constrict as much as he can the description of himself as humble. How can he write? And Moses was the most humble man in the world. Quote. How does he write that about himself? And the commentators presume that this was dictated by God. He had to write what he was told. But he tried to eliminate as much as he could to kind of get through it.
Shows how humble he was.
To show how humble he was, exactly. And that yud that he skipped, say again. So Vayikra, there's a small aleph for the same reason we'll come to, because God is saying, Vayikra, I summoned you, I elected you, Moshe. And then Midrash says that Moshe pushed back and says, I'll just write Vayikar and you happened upon me. It could have been anybody. I was just the right guy in the right place at the right time. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, no, you put the aleph in. I summoned you specifically for your talents, for your gifts, for you are the man of this moment. And Moshe compromises and puts a small aleph. So maybe there was some spare ink there as well. And this spare ink was smeared on his face, and that's why the light shone. That's the assumption. There is also a lot of contrast made between the first and second tablets. Not only the first one were broken, the second one. What made the second more enduring? And why does Moshe's face shine with the second and not in the first? The first time you'd imagine he'd come down the mountain, and before he broke them, his face is shining. He's holding the lucha. What was so sanctified about the second set that made his face shine more than the first? So Rabbi Sachs, I'll rely on again, has a piece in his book, To Heal a Fractured World. I think it's the second half of the book, where he writes precisely this in the name of all sorts of commentators, that the first set was a divine product. The first set was engraved by God, Etzba Elokim. The second set was formed by God, but written by Moshe. And the fact that human hands had a role in this is actually what made it more sacred. Something that's divine is beyond our reach, can't really manifest on earth. It just falls away, it crumbles. But something which we got our hands on and we involve ourselves makes it far more sacred. That was his view. Now, we're getting close to the end and we haven't done our piece under pressure, so we're going to turn to our sheet. I'd say page one just for the sake of it. So we're going to say page one. Now, I'm going to do something a little different this week. Usually we take a pasuk and we look through excesses or ambiguities or uncertainties or gaps, and we try to plug them or pressure them. But I want to take a step back and ask a general question. Moshe smashes the tablets. What happens to the broken pieces? They go in the Aron. How do we know? Other than that Saul just told us. How does Saul know? Someone told him. How did they know? How do we know? Say again?
Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Raiders of the Lost Ark, right. Harrison Ford told us. Well, we don't know. We don't see what's inside, do we?
No.
They open it up and some dust comes out.
No, spirits come out.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It gets all crazy. Right, but we don't see the contents. I mentioned...
It was a lot heavier when they were carrying it.
It was heavier because it had all the rubble in. We mentioned a couple weeks ago that the Malbim, in his radical view of how the Mishkan was modeled, or the human being was modeled on some archetype, where the number of beams in the Mishkan was the same as the number of vertebrae in the human body, that the menorah and the shulchan were like the lungs and the heart, the mizbeach was like the stomach that does all the digestion, and in the Holy of Holies you have the Aron Kodesh with the two luchot, which are the two hemispheres of the brain. And then we pointed out, well, what about the hippocampus at the bottom? And he says that was the shivrei luchot. So it was intentionally there in the Holy of Holies. That, again, was extreme reading that models the Mishkan on the human body. But it looks like that it was from the start intended that this rubble would be contained in the Aron. Now, the question is, we said, how do we know? The Gemara says it's actually not in a pasuk. It is derived from a verse in Devarim where there is an ambiguity about what happened to the second set. And the Gemara says this is in the first box underneath the pasuk. This is Menachot Tzadi Tet, Luchot V'Shivrei Luchot Menachim Ba'aron. And you'll hear that thrown around as a citation. It's from here. That the tablets and the broken tablets were put in the Aron. And now the question we ask is why? Why were these shattered fragments put in the Aron. If you were Moshe, if you were God, and you were trying to think about what is best, what is healthiest to do at this moment, the Jewish people betrayed God. A whole bunch of people died in a plague and in trauma because of their betrayal. And now I have to decide what to do with all this rubble. What might, if you were to gather a meeting of medical, psychological experts and say, what are the options for what we should do? What might you suggest?
Get rid of it.
Get rid of it. Bury it somewhere. Just, who would say, bring it with us? And don't just bring it with us. Put it in the middle of the camp. Put it with the other luchot. So why are they there?
They were holy, and they were proof that they had them originally. People later on would say that there were no first luchos.
Okay, interesting. So it had to be...
They said it was divine. Hashem made it.
But then it got smashed.
Yeah, but you can't get rid of it because it's...
Oh, so you've been hanging out with Rabbi Soloveitchik. So Rabbi Soloveitchik, I don't have on the sheet, but he does have a reading that Kedushah can't be shattered in that way, and it's still holy, so we had to keep it in somewhere. Your view that we're preserving it for the sake of history is fascinating. In theory, you could preserve something for history in a jar somewhere else. Moshe could have it on his belt. He doesn't have to put it in the Aron.
That's what we do with the man, right?
Right, there was man, there was some of the oil, there were other things that were kept in the Aron for preservation's sake. But the assumption of a number of readers, it wasn't just for preservation's sake, but there was also a symbolic pedagogical quality to having these things in the center of the camp. And I've got, in the time that remains, just a few different readings of the lesson, the message, the pedagogical aim of these objects, of the broken tablets being in the center of the camp. Number one, Sefer Reshit Chochma. And this is representative of a whole swathe of Hasidic readings, that you have these broken tablets in the middle to suggest that at the core of our psyches, we need to embrace that we are broken. If we understand that the Aron is representative of the human heart, the human soul, the human spirit, having whole perfected tablets would misrepresent what it means to be human. We are not perfect. We are not whole. We are not pristine. We are imperfect. There are parts of us that are crushed, that are fragmented, that are shattered, that are broken. In his words, Kis halev hu ha'aron, and the container of the heart is represented by the ark. V'nodahu shebetoch ha'aron ha'yelucha v'shivrei luchot, and inside of both the whole and broken tablets, kein ra'ui she'elibo male Torah. So our heart should be filled on the one hand, filled with Torah. Keneged shivrei luchot, tzarech she'elibo lev nishbar v'nidker. But we also have to have a broken heart. You have to be in touch with that brokenness at the core of who we are. It was, I'm going to get the name wrong. Who was a Canadian singer? It wasn't Leonard
Cohen.
Leonard Cohen, who has a song about everyone has a crack in, that's how the light gets in. Did I make that up?
Yeah. Broken Places.
Called Broken Places, that's what it's called. So he was an interesting figure. He actually converted, I think, to... Buddhism at one point, but
he just took it upon himself.
Oh, he experimented with Buddhism. He ended up being buried in a Jewish cemetery in Canada. Well, he was buried in the cemetery, but he had his funeral in a shul in Canada under the radar. He grew up, he had a bar mitzvah, yeah, and his last song was about the Akedah, I think. So an interesting figure. But either way, he had this this spirit of brokenness in a lot of his music. In fact, maybe his most famous one, because not because the Maccabees used it for Lacha Dodi, but it had Hallelujah. I'm not going to do the whole thing. Yeah, I'm thinking about it. I've heard that a lot lately. I was in a movie and I'm singing. People say, stick to your day job. All right, we'll see what we can do. I was going to go into musical theater. So a lot of his music was about brokenness. And in our age specifically, it is worth focusing on that because we aim for perfection and we consider a lot of what we do to be in progress. But we have to constantly be conscious of the fact that there's things that we can't do. And actually, in the next box, Rav Yuval Sherlow. Anyone heard of Rav Yuval Sherlow? He's a contemporary figure. He's one of the rabbinic leaders, I think, of Petach Tikva, the yeshiva in Petach Tikva, the yeshiva at Hezen Petach Tikva. And he's very engaged with a lot of contemporary issues. He's written a couple of books that came out called Shut Bereshut HaRabim, which is Shut is an acronym for Charlotte Uchuvot, which is responsa, brishut harabim, basically public issues in rabbinic responsa. And he has a radio show where people all over Israel call in, talk about contemporary halachic queries, quandaries, whether it's in the army or in the workplace or in Shemitah, all other things, and he addresses these issues there. And one of his, he's got something on the parsha that I found that he writes this, that in life we tend to begin ideological. And we aim high with big dreams, big ambitions, big goals. And more often than not, they don't work out. Our dreams falter, our ambitions get shattered, our hopes don't materialize, and things fall apart, and we have to start again. And we started with this almost prophetic, divinely received vision of what we want to do. It doesn't work, and we have to basically start with our own hands, like the second set of Luchot, from the point, from the ground up. And he says the message of the Shivrei Luchot being there is that we should never lose sight of what that initial goal was. We shouldn't come to terms and concede to our human limits by lowering the bar. We should understand reality gets in the way, that sometimes we can't achieve big goals straight away. But we shouldn't lose sight of the goal, even as we start from lower, which is an interesting psychological point. Now, the sages in the next box, the Gemara in Brachot, has one of the more profound readings of this. It suggests that actually the message of the broken tablets is a moral message, not about how to live one's life, not how to condition one's psyche, but how to treat other people. Hisharu bazakein sheshachach talmudo machmat onso. The Gemara says, be wary, be careful, be sensitive to an elder who has forgotten their learning against their will. Meaning, as people age, people forget things. And of course, in the most extreme circumstances, people who are struck with dementia illnesses forget almost everything. It's not just they forget, I don't remember what I said yesterday, I don't remember where I put this, but names, places, people. And the sense here is, da amrinan luchot v'shivrei luchot munachin ba'aron, just because something is a shell of its former self, just because something seems broken, just because something is fractured, doesn't mean that it is cast out and buried under a mountain and left alone. It comes with us, and it doesn't just come with us, it sits in the Aron Kodesh. And this is sensitizing us to those who are no longer what they once were. And this can be taken from elders who are suffering from dementia, and it can be a much broader message as well about people who are not at their prime, not at their peak anymore. And in the realm of knowledge, that tends to shift quite late in life. There are some fields, literally, like sport. When people reach peak of their sport life, at what age? Depending on the sport.
25.
Depending on the sport, it can be in your 20s. You've hit your peak at your 20s. You've got to live, please God, another 60, 70 years on this earth with everybody thinking, oh, you're not really what you were. And the suggestion here is we don't measure people by how they are. Now we measure people by their best at every moment, and they deserve, and that comes with them, and that is enshrined in the Aron Kodesh. I do want to finish, though, with an interesting reading I came across in a clip on YouTube, because sometimes you find not just cat videos, but interesting things on YouTube. Although some cat videos, I'm sure, are interesting too. So Daniel Taub was the ambassador to the United Kingdom of the State of Israel until about 3 years ago. He wrote also a book called Diplomacy in the Parsha. I think it's Diplomatica, but Parsha, it's in Hebrew, it's not in English. And he interviewed Rabbi Sacks at one point when one of Rabbi Sacks' books was coming out. And I guess for the sake of plugging him, his new book called Morality, Finding Common Ground in Divided Times, comes out in the UK today. It doesn't come out in America until September 1st. Nobody knows why. It's a different publisher, different printer. But if you want it now, you can order it in England and have it shipped. You can wait till September 2. Either way, one of his previous books, I think it was Not in God's Name, about religious violence. He was interviewed by Daniel Taub, and they were talking about this. And Daniel Taub made a suggestion. He was very interesting. Guy is an observant religious figure, originally from London. Went to Israel, then was sent back as an ambassador. And he suggested, you can read it yourself, but he suggested that maybe the contents of these shattered luchot were put in the Aron Kodesh, not because they were sacred. Maybe they kept the sanctity, maybe they didn't. We can't make halachic judgments, he says, like Rabbi Soloveitchik makes halachic chakiras about the luchot. I don't know how the luchot work. Maybe they lost their sanctity. The assumption in the Midrash is the letters flew off, that this was just a pile of rubble. In theory, could have been left somewhere. So why was it put inside? Not because they were sacred, he says, because they were dangerous. Dangerous. And his argument was, partial truth is dangerous. Imagine later in history, people find these luchot and they say, the Jews never got it. I found the truth, but it's broken up into pieces. And they come along this piece, and it's this glowing piece of sapphire, and it's clear that this is the communication from God. And they pick it up, and it says one word on it. And what does it say? Tirzach! Which means, you shall kill. This is the divine word. Or as you say, not tirzach, tinaf! Commit adultery! And you put it up. You pick up tignov. Still, you get partial truth and you miss the low. It's incredibly dangerous and harmful. So everything had to be stored inside, not because it was sacred per se, but because leaving it out would have been too dangerous. To scatter the world with partial truth would be horrific and rip at the core of what it means to have a civilization. And of course, we feel that perhaps more intensely today. And I say we, in a projected sense, when we live in a world of technological partiality, where every minute we don't know what the truth is, and we're hearing snippets from here and snippets from there, and we don't know which sources to trust and who's telling the truth, and we are searching desperately for an anchor. And I don't necessarily have an answer to that. But merely to be cognizant of that tension is helpful in itself, to understand that there is a danger in taking partial truth as the final word. And that it needs to be stored inside just to contain is an essential lesson as well. Next week we will meet for Parashat, is it V'yakal Bukure together? I hope so. Excellent. V'yakal Bukure together, that will be next week, and we'll go from there. Next week we may be meeting in the main sanctuary. I will